Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for April the 16th. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Gary. Front page articles include: after Harvard rejects demands, Trump adds new threat. CDC advisors discuss narrowing use of COVID-19 booster shots. Doge may have caused significant cyber breach at labor watchdog. U.S. transfers land on Mexico border to Army to prevent illegal crossing. Now going back to our first article. After Harvard rejects demands, Trump adds new threats. President Donald Trump threatened to strip Harvard of its tax-exempt status on Tuesday and said the university should apologize, the day after it rejected what it called unlawful demands to overhaul academic programs or lose federal grants. Beginning with Columbia University, the Trump administration has rebuked universities across the country over their handling of the pro-Palestinian student protest movement that roiled campuses last year following the 2023 Hamas-led attack inside Israel and the subsequent Israeli attacks on Gaza. Trump has called the protests anti-US and anti-Semitic, accused universities of peddling Marxism and radical left ideology, and promised to end federal grants and contracts to universities that do not agree to his administration's demands. Some professors, students, and university presidents have said the protests are being unfairly conflated with anti-Semitism as a pretext for an unconstitutional attack on academic freedom. Columbia, a private school in New York City, agreed to negotiations after the Trump administration said last month it had terminated grants and contracts worth $400 million, most for medical and other scientific research. Harvard President Alan Garber, in a letter on Monday, said demands that the Trump administration made of the Massachusetts University, including an audit to ensure the viewpoint diversity of its students and faculty, and an end to all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, were unprecedented assertions of power, unmoored from the law, that violated constitutional free speech rights and the Civil Rights Act. Like Columbia, he said Harvard had been working to fight anti-Semitism and other forms of discrimination on its campus while preserving academic freedoms and the right to protest. Hours after Garber released his letter, the Trump administration's Joint Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism said it was freezing more than $2 billion in contracts and grants to Harvard, the country's oldest and richest university. The administration did not respond to questions about which grants and contracts had been cut, and Harvard did not respond to requests for comment. Trump, a Republican, said in a social media post on Tuesday he was mulling whether to seek to end Harvard's tax-exempt status if it continued pushing what he called political, ideological, and terrorist-inspired supporting sickness. He did not say how he would do this. Under the U.S. tax code, most universities are exempt from federal income tax because they are deemed to be operating exclusively for educational purposes. White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt told reporters Trump wanted to see Harvard apologize for what she called anti-Semitism that took place on their college campus against Jewish American students. She accused Harvard and other schools of violating Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination by recipients of federal funding based on race or national origin. Under Title VI, federal funds can be terminated only after lengthy investigation and hearings process and a 30-day notification to Congress, which has not happened at Columbia or Harvard. Moving to our next article, CDC advisors discuss narrowing use of COVID-19 booster shots. U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention outside panel of vaccine experts on Tuesday discussed narrowing recommendations on the use of COVID-19 booster shots for the upcoming immunization campaign in its first meeting under the new Trump administration. The panel raised the idea of recommending the updated vaccine only for vulnerable populations at risk of severe COVID-19 for the 2025-26 season. While most panel members were not opposed, they voiced concerns around the difficulties of implementing the approach. Denise Jameson, one of the panel members, said the U.S. has a history of not being able to implement such variable recommendations and that COVID is still a leading cause of death among both adults and children. Even though I'm very much in favor of considering a risk-based approach, I am concerned about the feasibility of it and the message it might be sending, said Jamie Lohr, another panelist. A majority of CDC's working group favored the risk-based approach compared to the current near-universal recommendation. The panel is set to vote on formal recommendations in its June meeting. The agency currently recommends that individuals aged 6 months and older should be given an updated COVID-19 vaccine, regardless of previous inoculations for the disease. A potential risk-based recommendation would eat into the already dwindling COVID vaccine sales for drug makers such as Pfizer and Moderna, city analysts said in a research note. The Advisory Committee on Immunizations Practices will vote on Wednesday on recommendations for use of three vaccines also discussed during the two-day meeting, shots for respiratory Sertralvirus, chikungunya, a mosquito-borne disease, and meningococcal vaccines. The panel also plans to discuss the ongoing U.S. measles outbreak that has infected over 700 people this year, mostly among young, unvaccinated residents in Texas and New Mexico. The meeting was abruptly delayed in February, just days after Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s longtime vaccine skeptic became head of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. CDC, which is part of HHS, said the meeting had been postponed to allow for public comment. Today's long-delayed ACIP meeting harks what we think are early indications of a more relaxed CDC under Kennedy's purview of the HHS, city analysts said. CDC's director typically approves the panel's recommendations before they are implemented, but the agency does not currently have one. President Donald Trump nominated Susan Monteri to lead CDC after withdrawing the nomination of former Republican congressman and vaccine critic David Welton, but she has yet to be confirmed by the Senate. Moving to our next article, DOGE may have caused significant cyber breach at labor watchdog. A whistleblower complaint says that Elon Musk's team of technologists may have been responsible for a significant cybersecurity breach, likely of sensitive case files at America's Federal Labor Watchdog. The complaint, addressed to Republican Senate Intelligence Commerce Committee Tom Cotton and his Democratic counterpart Mark Warner, and made public Tuesday by the group Whistleblower Aid, draws on the testimony of Daniel Barris, an information technology staffer at National Labor Relations Board. NLRB, a New Deal-era agency that is tasked with protecting workers' rights to organize and join unions, has for years been a target of America's corporate titans, including Musk. some of whom are now seeking to have the agency's powers declared unconstitutional. In an affidavit, Barris said he had evidence that Doeg staffers were given extraordinary sweeping access to NLRB systems, which house sensitive case files. He said that beginning in early March, logging protocols created to audit users appeared to have been tampered with, and that he had detected the removal of about 10 gigabytes worth of data from NLRB's network sometime thereafter. Barris told Reuters in an interview Tuesday that the data in question includes proprietary business information from competitors, union organization, and unfair labor practice respondents and their claims, including private affidavits. The kind of spike is extremely unusual because data almost never directly leaves NLRB's database, Barris has said in his affidavit. A spokesperson for Musk's team, officially known as U.S. Doeg Service, didn't immediately return a message seeking comment. A message left with NLRB also wasn't immediately returned, although NPR, which first reported the story, quoted an NLRB spokesperson as disputing Barris's claims and saying there had been no breach. Cotton and Warner didn't immediately return messages seeking comment. Barris alleged in the affidavit that their attempted logins to NLRB systems from an IP address in Russia in days after Doeg accessed the systems. He told Reuters Tuesday that the attempted logins apparently included correct username and password combinations, but were rejected by location-related conditional access policies. Barris's affidavit said that an effort by him and his colleagues to formally investigate and alert the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency was disrupted by higher-ups without explanation. As he and his colleagues prepared to pass information they'd gathered to CISA, he received a threatening note taped to the door of his home with photographs of him walking in his neighborhood, taken by a drone. Andrew Bakshak, Whistleblower Aid's chief legal counsel, said in a submission to Cotton and Warner, "Unlike any other time previously, there is this fear to speak out because of reprisals." Barris told Reuters, "We're seeing data that is traditionally safeguarded with highest standards in the United States government being taken, and the people that do try to stop it from happening, the people that are saying no, they're being removed one by one." Bakshak declined to share the note with Reuters. FBI declined to comment. A message left with CISA wasn't immediately returned. Moving to our next article, U.S. transfers land on Mexico border to Army to prevent illegal crossing. The Trump administration announced an emergency transfer of nearly 110,000 acres of federal land along the U.S.-Mexico border to the Army to help prevent illegal immigration, the Interior Department said on Tuesday. The move is part of President Donald Trump's sweeping immigration crackdown. He declared illegal immigration a national emergency in January and tasked the U.S. military with aiding in border security. The land will be transferred to the Department of the Army for 3 years, the agency said, allowing for patrols by federal personnel and construction of infrastructure to prevent illegal crossings. The move is intended to help curb drug and human trafficking and migrant smuggling, but is also aimed at protecting ecologically sensitive areas that can be harmed by foot traffic, Interior said. Securing our border and protecting our national resources go hand in hand, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said in a statement. The American people gave President Trump a mandate to make America safe and strong again. This transfer reflects Interior's commitment to public safety, national security, and responsible stewardship of our public lands. Now, moving to our next article. Jury selection opens in Weinstein sexual crime trial. New York. Jury selection began Tuesday in Harvey Weinstein's new trial on rape and sexual assault charges in Manhattan, a year after a state appeals court overturned the former movie mogul's 2020 conviction. Weinstein, 73, faces one rape count and two criminal sexual act counts in the jury trial, with Superior Court Justice Curtis Farber presiding. Weinstein, who co-founded the Miramax studio and was once one of Hollywood's most influential producers, has pled not guilty and is denied ever assaulting anyone or having non-consensual sex. His conviction was a capstone moment for the Me Too movement, which encouraged women to come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct by powerful men in media, politics, and other spheres. Weinstein, who is experiencing a variety of health problems, was brought into the courtroom in a wheelchair. He wore a blue suit with a blue tie and smiled as he spoke with his legal team. The trial is expected to last roughly 6 weeks. Farber and lawyers for both sides will question and select 12 jurors from a pool of Manhattan residents. The verdict must be unanimous to convict. The first day of jury selection concluded with no jurors selected and will continue Wednesday. A jury found Weinstein guilty of rape and sexual assault in 2020, and he was sentenced to 23 years in prison. A state appeals court threw out the conviction in April of 2024 and ordered a new trial, finding that women who accused Weinstein of assaults that were not part of the charges against him should not have been allowed to testify. Prosecutors with Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office have accused Weinstein of sexually assaulting former production assistant Miriam Haley in 2006 and raping aspiring actress Jessica Mann in 2013, charges he was convicted of in the first trial. In the retrial, Weinstein also faces a new charge of allegedly assaulting an unidentified woman in Manhattan in 2006. During the first trial, prosecutors portrayed Weinstein as a serial predator who manipulated women with promises of career advancement in Hollywood, coaxed them into hotel rooms or private apartments, and then overpowered and attacked them. Weinstein is likely to spend the rest of his life in prison, even if he is acquitted in the retrial in New York, because he was sentenced to 16 years after being separately convicted of rape in California. He has yet to begin serving that sentence and has remained in custody in New York since his conviction there was overturned. In September, Weinstein was rushed to a hospital and underwent emergency heart surgery. The episode was one of several health scares while he was held in New York City's Rikers Island jail, where his representatives had said he was receiving inadequate medical care. More than 100 women, including famous actresses, accused Weinstein of misconduct, and the allegations against him were a focal point of Me Too. He denied the allegations and said any sexual encounters he had were consensual. Lindsay Goldberg, an attorney representing the new unidentified victim, said in a statement Monday that the trial is a pivotal moment in the fight against sexual abuse. More than 7 years after Me Too, this case will test how far we're advanced in our collective understanding of sexual assault, power dynamics, and what it means to be a survivor, Goldbrum said. Weinstein's film studio filed for bankruptcy in March of 2018, collapsing after the original accusations of sexual misconduct. NAACP sues Education Department over DEI funding cuts. NAACP on Tuesday sued U.S. Department of Education to stop its alleged illegal effort to cut off funding to schools that use diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and prevent Black students from receiving equal education opportunities. In a complaint filed in Washington, D.C., the largest U.S. civil rights group faulted the Trump administration for targeting programs that offer truthful, inclusive curriculum, policies to give Black Americans equal access to selective education opportunities, and efforts to foster a sense of belonging and address racism. It also said the policies advanced a misinterpretation of federal civil rights laws and Supreme Court precedent that undermine NAACP members' equal protection rights and protections from viewpoint discrimination under the U.S. Constitution. The Education Department did not immediately respond to requests for comment on the federal lawsuit. President Donald Trump has made ending racial preferences in so-called DEI programs a top priority in his second White House term. On February 14th, DOE sent a Dear Colleague letter to schools receiving federal funding. The letter said federal law prevented the schools from considering race as a factor in areas such as admissions, hiring and promotion, pay, financial aid, scholarships and prizes, housing, and graduation ceremonies. Then on April 3rd, the department demanded certifications of compliance from schools, including an end to DEI programs. It said this was required by Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bars recipients from allowing discrimination based on race, and a 2023 Supreme Court decision involving Harvard University that effectively ended race conscious admissions in higher education. While the department agreed in a separate lawsuit in New Hampshire not to enforce the Dear Colleague letter until April the 24th, NAACP said some schools have lost funding while others have flinched and canceled programs. It cited the Waterloo, Iowa school district's withdrawal of first grade students from the University of Northern Iowa's annual African American Read-In, which nearly 3,500 students at 73 schools attended. NAACP President Derek Johnson accused the White House of effectively sanctioning discrimination that U.S. civil rights laws were designed to prevent. Moving to our next article, Trump exempts dozens of coal plants from mercury air toxin limit. The Donald Trump administration has exempted 47 companies from regulations to curb mercury and air toxins for coal-fired power plants for 2 years, according to a list of facilities published Tuesday by U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The exemptions listed is the latest move by the administration to use executive or emergency orders to immediately shield polluting facilities from compliance with air and water standards tightened by the Biden administration as EPA undertakes a lengthier process to roll back those rules. The Biden era mercury and air toxin standard is still in force after the Supreme Court in October declined to put the rules on hold after a group of mostly Republican states and industry groups led a legal challenge to suspend it. But U.S. President Donald Trump issued a proclamation last week detailing that certain stationary sources of subject to MATS are exempt from compliance in a bid to revive the coal industry and prolong the life of aging coal power plants. Coal-burning plants generate less than 20% of U.S. electricity, a drop from 50% in 2000, according to the Energy Information Administration, as fracking and other drilling techniques have hiked production of natural gas. Growth in solar and wind power has also cut coal use. Mercury is a potent neurotoxin the American Lung Association says could cause severe developmental harm. Mercury and other air toxins associated with coal burning raise the risk of asthma attacks, strokes, heart attacks, and lung cancer. The Biden-era rule required constant monitoring of emissions. Supporters of the exemption said the MATS rule placed severe burdens on coal-fired power plants and on the viability of the U.S. coal sector. Montana Congressman Troy Downing applauded the inclusion of two units of Colstrip coal plant to the exemption list, adding that it will provide clarity and certainty for operations going forward. Now moving to some articles from across the West. California sets aside $17 million to thin vegetation and forest to help prevent wildfires. California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed legislation that provides $170 million in state funding to help prevent wildfires while signing an order aimed at speeding up the work by easing environmental permitting. The funding comes as the state is under extraordinary pressure after the January infernos that devastated Los Angeles communities. California has already experienced its second most destructive fire year on record, with more than 16,000 homes and other buildings damaged or destroyed by the two major fires in the Los Angeles area. Most of the destruction occurred in neighborhoods where development meets wildland, a high-risk area known as the Wildland Urban Interface. The money comes from a $10 billion bond measure for environmental projects approved by California voters last year. Moving to our next article, Utah Regional Airport takes steps to expand in advance of the 2034 Olympics. About 50 miles from Utah's Capitol Airport is a small hub that some travelers on Wasatch Front turn to for ultra-low-cost carriers, the Provo Airport. In 2024, about 900,000 passengers used the airport's four gates to board domestic flights. It was a record-setting number for the facility. However, as soon as this year, that number could multiply. Provo City broke ground for an airport expansion on Monday. The plans are to build an extended apron, increasing parking capacity for aircraft by November, according to the city. One of the most substantial changes, however, is scheduled to open by late 2028. The facility's expansion to host 10 gates. Thanks to American Airlines' frequent daily flights to Dallas-Fort Worth and Phoenix Sky Harbor, travelers from PVU now enjoy easy access to over 270 global designations, both domestic and international, said Brian Torgerson, Provo Airport Director. And the connectivity will only improve with our expansion from four gates to 10 gates. Now moving to some global stories. At conference, Britain, EU boost aid for Sudan. Britain and European Union on Tuesday pledged to increase aid for Sudan at a conference in London, marking the second anniversary of a conflict that has displaced millions and devastated the country. Britain said the conference aimed to improve the coherence of international response to the crisis. Although Sudan's government criticized the gathering because no representative from either side of the conflict was invited. In a statement, the conference's co-chairs called for an immediate and permanent ceasefire to end the conflict and back the transition to a civilian-led government elected by the Sudanese people. The international community stressed the necessity of preventing any partition of Sudan, the co-chairs added. The participants underscored that the non-interference by outside actors remains paramount. The war in Sudan erupted in April of 2023, sparked by a power struggle between the army and Sudan's rapid support forces, shattering hopes for a transition to civilian rule. It has killed tens of thousands, displaced millions, and devastated regions like Darfur. It has also drawn in several foreign powers. European Union and member states pledged $592 million to address the crisis, while Britain announced an extra $158 million in aid. Britain Foreign Secretary David Lammy said the international community had to persuade the warring parties to protect civilians and let aid in, and he hoped the conference would establish principles for future engagement. We do need patient diplomacy, he told delegates at the start of the conference. We cannot resign ourselves to inevitable conflict. We cannot be back here 1 year from now having the same discussion. Britain has co-hosted the conference with African Union, European Union, France, and Germany. Egypt, Kenya, and United Arab Emirates are among the other attendees. Now moving to a sports article. LA 2028 announced venues. Baseball at Dodger Stadium, triathlon at Venice Beach. Los Angeles Dodgers will host Olympics baseball in 2028, while surfers will hope to ride the waves to the podium in San Clemente. It was announced on Tuesday as organizers unveiled an array of venues for the Los Angeles Games. The competition will be sprawled out around the greater Los Angeles region, with beach volleyball enjoying surfside digs at Alamitos Beach and squash getting a little Hollywood razz-dazzle in its Olympic debut on the Universal Studio lot. Triathlon competitors will show off their muscles at Venice Beach while cricket makes its Olympic return after more than a century at the distant fairgrounds in Pomona, with Anaheim hosting volleyball. Boxing returns to the Olympic lineup in 2028, with early rounds set for the Peacock Theater and finals taking place at the arena in downtown Los Angeles. As the host city for the 2028 Games, Los Angeles will become the third city in the history of the world to host the Summer Olympics 3 times, and these venues will showcase the best of our city to a global audience, said City of Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass. Now moving to some business articles. Wall Street finishes down slightly. Tariff uncertainty keeps investors on edge. U.S. stocks ended slightly lower on Tuesday as tariff uncertainty stayed high and shares of consumer and healthcare companies eased, while upbeat results from banks provided some support. Quarterly results from companies including Bank of America and Citigroup lifted financials, which led S&P 500 sector gains. Still, bank executives warned that U.S. consumer spending faces huge risks if the upheaval sparked by President Donald Trump's trade policy goes on. Federal Register filing on Monday showed the Trump administration was also proceeding with probes into imports of pharmaceuticals and semiconductors as part of a bid to impose tariffs on the sectors. Trump announced sweeping tariffs on April the 2nd, sparking turmoil in the market and fueling worries about a global trade war and possible recession, investors have been unable to focus on much else since then. Earnings have been pretty good, but this is a market that's just beset by tariff and trade uncertainty, and those are really the only catalysts that matter at this point, said Ross Mayfield, investment strategist at Baird in Louisville, Kentucky. Moving to our next article, Honda isn't considering changes to Canada-Mexico auto operations. Honda said it had no plan to move car production from Canada and Mexico to the U.S., responding to a report that it might move operations in an effort to avoid potentially devastating tariffs. No changes are being considered at this time, Honda Canada said in an email statement. Honda has not made any production decisions that affect operations in Mexico, nor are any currently being considered, Honda Mexico said in an email statement. The Nikkei newspaper earlier said Honda was considering switching some car production from Mexico and Canada to the United States, aiming for 90% of cars sold in the country to be made there, in response to new U.S. auto tariffs. Japan's second biggest automaker by sales plans to increase U.S. vehicle production by as much as 30% over 2 to 3 years in response to U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to put a 25% levy on imported vehicles, Nikki said. We constantly study options for future contingency planning and utilize short-term production shift strategies when required, Honda Canada said. We are confident in our ability to continue navigating current market conditions effectively. Honda Canada, the second largest domestic auto manufacturer by volume in 2024, operates a plant in Alliston, Ontario. Mexican Economy Minister Marcelo Ebrard said on Tuesday in an ex post that Honda executives in the country had told the government they have no plans to modify their production there. Honda has plants in the states of Guanajuato and Jalisco. In the weeks before the new U.S. levy went into effect, Reuters reported that Honda planned to make its next generation Civic hybrid in the U.S. state of Indiana instead of Mexico to avoid potential tariffs. The U.S. was Honda's biggest market last year, accounting for nearly 40% of global sales. The automaker sold 1.4 million vehicles, including Acura models, in the U.S. last year. It imported about 40% of those cars from Canada and Mexico. Honda posted a 5% rise in U.S. sales to almost 352,000 vehicles in the first 3 months of this year. The company will move production of the CR-V SUV from Canada and the HR-V SUV from Mexico to the U.S., according to Nikkei. To increase output, Honda is considering hiring more U.S. workers, the newspaper said. Such a step would make it possible for Honda to switch to a three-shift system from two shifts and extend production to weekends. Our next article, UAW members at General Dynamics Electric Boat Unit authorized strike. Union members at General Dynamics Electric Boat Unit voted to authorize a strike, the United Auto Workers said Tuesday. The move comes amid an ongoing labor dispute post the expiration of the members' contract on April 4 at Electric Boat, a part of the Defense Contractors Marine Systems segment, which assembles nuclear-powered submarines for the U.S. Navy. The union report represents over 2,400 Marine drafters who designed submarines at the unit and are fighting to win cost of living adjustments to keep pace with inflation along with affordable health care. The union members are also seeking the restoration of pensions as they argue that General Dynamics is pushing for increases of 52% to 161% in weekly medical insurance costs. General Dynamics has received significant contract awards from the Pentagon for building the Navy's Virginia-class submarines, but is years behind schedule because of skilled labor shortages, design issues, and supply chain challenges stemming from the pandemic. Inferior compensation at Electric Boat is leading to worker shortages and production delays, UAW says. In January, General Dynamics CEO Prib Novacek flagged continued pressure on the marine system segment margins owing to additional delays and quality issues from the submarine supply chain weighing on costs. Moving to our next article, OpenAI is working on X-like social media network. OpenAI is working on an X-like social media network, The Verge reported on Tuesday, citing multiple sources familiar with the matter. There is an internal prototype focused on ChatGPT's image generation that has a social feed, the report said. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman has been privately asking outsiders for feedback about the project, which is still in early stages, according to The Verge. It is unclear whether the company plans to release the social network as a separate application or integrate it into ChatGPT, the report said. The company did not immediately respond to a Reuters request for comment. The potential move could escalate tensions between Altman and billionaire Elon Musk, owner of X and OpenAI co-founder, who left the startup in 2018 before it emerged as a front runner in the generative artificial intelligence race. The feud has intensified in recent months. In February, a consortium of investors led by Musk made an unsolicited $97.4 billion bid for the control of OpenAI, only to be rejected by Altman with a swift no thank you. Musk has sued the ChatGPT maker and Altman last year, alleging they had abandoned OpenAI's original goal of developing AI for the benefit of humanity, not corporate gain. OpenAI countersued Musk earlier this month, accusing him of a pattern of harassment and attempting to derail its shift to a for-profit model. The two parties are set to begin a jury trial in spring of next year. An OpenAI social network could also put the company in direct competition with Facebook-owned owner Meta, which is reportedly working on a standalone Meta AI service. In February, Altman responded on X over media reports on Meta's plans, saying, "Okay, fine, maybe we'll do a social app." Both Meta and X have access to a massive amount of data, public content posted by users on their social media platforms that they train their AI models on. Moving to our next article, marijuana legalization hits roadblock after years of expansion. As every state surrounding Idaho legalized marijuana, State Representative Bruce Scoggs started to view it as inevitable that the gem state would follow suit. Not anymore. Scoggs supported two bills this legislative session taking aim at marijuana use, one to impose a mandatory minimum $300 fine for possession, and another that would take away the right of voters to legalize pot through the ballot box. He believes other states are starting to regret liberalization marijuana use because of potential health concerns and lackluster revenues from marijuana sales. Looking around at other states that have legalized marijuana, it's not improved their state as a place to raise a family, to do business, he said. It just hasn't come through with the promise that we heard years ago for those states. Idaho is not alone. After years of expanding legal access, lawmakers in several states this year have targeted marijuana in various ways. To help close budget gaps, officials in Maryland, Michigan, and New Jersey have proposed raising marijuana taxes. Health concerns have pushed lawmakers in states including Colorado and Montana to attempt to cap the level of tetrahydrocannabinoid, or THC, the primary psychoactive component in cannabis, in marijuana products sold at dispensaries. And some lawmakers have even tried to roll back voter-approved medical marijuana programs. This year, in particular, we're playing defense a lot more than we have in the past, said Morgan Fox, political director at the advocacy group National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML. In some extent, he said, the pendulum on marijuana liberalization is swinging back, but Fox said recent legislative efforts are not indicative of wanting public support for legalization. He said, prohibitionist politicians have been emboldened to act against the will of voters. Polling from the Pew Research Center has found little change in support for legalization in recent years. 50% of U.S. adults say that marijuana should be legal for medical and recreational purposes. Colorado and Washington State began allowing recreational marijuana sales in 2014. Today, 24 states in the District of Columbia allow recreational sales, and 39 states in the district have sanctioned medical marijuana. There's been this air of inevitability for a while, said Daniel Mallison, an associate professor of public policy at Penn State Harrisburg, who researches marijuana legislation. With medical marijuana programs operational in most states, Mallison said there is pressure to expand recreational marijuana, especially given uncertainty over whether the federal government will act on the issue. Recreational is still in its takeoff period, he said, but he acknowledged that new medical research has raised concerns among some lawmakers. One study published in January found a link between heavy marijuana use and the memory function. Other studies have found a higher risk of heart attacks among people who use cannabis. Mallison said the research on marijuana is very young, as many institutions are wary of conducting clinical trials because of federal drug laws. The federal government classifies marijuana as a Schedule I drug, the same classification as drugs such as heroin and ecstasy. There is a mixture of science and politics in this area, he said. I could imagine seeing in these really conservative states like Idaho, you know, it's this kind of backlash, like we don't want this here at all, so we're going to try to put up barriers to even considering it. In Idaho, Skaggs said he pursued the state's new mandatory $300 fine for marijuana possession to bring more consistency to how the state handles marijuana cases. While Idaho law previously allowed fines up to $1,000, he said judges had issued fines as low as $2.50. So that wasn't the right message. That's not even worth the time to write the ticket, he said. So it's not that we're going to arrest more people for misdemeanor possession of marijuana, but there will be more citations in the amount of $300. Scott also backed a proposal, constitutional amendment, that would give only the legislature the power to legalize marijuana and other drugs. That question will go to voters next year. Skog says he's worried outside groups would influence a public vote to legalize marijuana by pouring millions into a ballot initiative campaign. If the amendment he supports passes, it wouldn't ban pot. It would leave legalization up to lawmakers. If the evidence comes back that says marijuana or some other drug is positive in the medical community and a good thing, then the legislature can legalize that, he said. But we're going to leave it with the legislator. You are listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand from our website. Choose broadcast, info, and audio, then on demand. Moving to our next article, psychologists, perceived consensus drives moral intolerance. To live together in social communities, people create and maintain expectations about what is normal and what is not. Sometimes things can fall outside the range of normal and people are okay with it. You might have a neighbor who likes to wear Revolutionary War costumes on their evening walks around the neighborhood. Their behavior seems weird to you, but you consider it an instance of everyone's freedom to express themselves. But at other times, something seems not only abnormal, but also unacceptable. In this case, people take active steps to squelch what feels unfair, inappropriate, bad, or deviant. Things that people think are morally abnormal, aberrant behavior, transgressions, violations of their most sacred values, are viewed as highly threatening and necessary to shut down, with force if necessary. Most people would find a neighbor who purposefully starves and tortures their dog morally repugnant. That neighbor would need to be stopped and would deserve to be punished. A decade of research in my psychology lab and others demonstrates that people struggle to express tolerance for different moral values. For instance, about sexual orientation, helping the poor, being a stay-at-home mother, and so on. In study after study, people are less willing to help, share with, date, be roommates with, and even work for people who have different moral values. Even children and adolescents express more willingness to shun and punish moral transgressors than people who do something personally obnoxious or offensive, but not immoral. When asked to talk with a stranger who they know disagrees with them, people will turn their bodies away more and move further away when the disagreement involves a moral rather than a personal disagreement. And they are more willing to condone using violence against someone who doesn't share their morals. All this sounds like bad news for societies like ours, filled with people who hold diverse moral values. But there is an important counterbalance to this blanket intolerance. When people sense disagreement within their community about moral issues, it pushes them to have tolerance for people with other views. In other words, when it is clear that people you see as your peers, members of your community, disagree with each other, you recognize the need for continued respectful discussion. It automatically tones down the natural tendency toward intolerance for moral views that differ from your own. While perceived disagreement within a community appears to function as a corrective to intolerance, the opposite is also true. Consensus is a powerful trigger of intolerance. When most of the community agrees that something is morally bad, then those who disagree are viewed as outliers and labeled as deviant. intolerance becomes not only justified, but is seen as necessary. But how is consensus reached? In diverse democratic societies like ours, where people are allowed to form their own opinions, there are two ways this might happen. The democratic ideal is that over time, through shared discussion and reflection, people eventually come to an agreement or compromise. More often, though, consensus is achieved when the disagreement becomes strong enough to fracture communities into multiple smaller issue position groups. What is problematic is that issue position groups, by definition, create consensus, signaling to their members that they, and not the other group, have got things right. Civility toward the other side is no longer required. The other viewpoint, and anyone who holds it, is considered morally wrong. Intolerance, though, can become a moral mandate. Members of issue position groups often find themselves on a moral crusade against the other side. That's all the time we have for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona and Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Gary. Thanks for listening.